They're not allowed to say, I wouldn't marry this person who I really wanted to marry because there's something wrong with the family. We see this ourselves, which is we marry people notwithstanding a certain discomfort level with their in-laws or their brothers or their sisters. Rashi is telling us that the general rule is that a person who's found a person who's right for her, shalem is the word Rashi uses, we don't apply the principle of this person wouldn't have entered into this marriage with the person that they want because of a double contingency. What's the double contingency? Number one, maybe this person won't have children. Number two, maybe I'll fall in front of the loathsome brother, and the loathsome brother will insist on performing yibum and asalisa. Those two cases are so far away, so distant, that we wouldn't say that, and we would instead apply the principle that this woman is happy being married, and a woman is better off being married than being single. Tosus, and I reproduced three of them on the side, ask the basic questions that define the contours of this problem. So Tosus asks, in the Tosus Shiloh, which the number two is next to, what about the case, taking the Gemara and Kulin, Moser para nimsa trefo mecho bato, a person buys a cow, the cow is found to be treif, not kosher, the sale is void. The reason why the sale is void is because the sale is void because the purchaser intended to buy the cow for what purpose? To eat it. He bought the cow without the purpose, without the ability to eat it, meaning they slaughtered it, they found a defect. Having slaughtered it and found a defect, he's allowed to say, the sale is void. Tosus asks the following question. What about you purchase the cow that's shalem, it's full and complete and edible, and while you're walking away with it, it gets hit by a car, trips and falls and becomes treif. Can you return it to the seller and say, I wouldn't have bought it had I known that this was going to happen in the future? Tosus says, of course not. Of course not. And the reason why you can't do it is because you're only allowed to impose contingencies on a marriage that, or on a sale, that are present at the time of the sale. We all take risks. The risk that we take when we buy a cow is that its current condition will change. And those are the risks associated with every sale. Now, if I buy the cow and at the moment of the sale, I think it's edible, or the purchaser thinks it's edible, and the seller thinks it's edible, and that's wrong, that's called mekach tov. That's called a void sale. However, if at the moment that I buy it, or the moment that I sell it, it's in the exact condition that I represent it to be, and something happens in the future, that's not a void sale at all. That's one of the risks we all take in life. This is very important to understand. We never say, adaita dahafi lo iskasha, or adaita dahafi lo nimkara. We never say either of those two things when the change occurs after the kinyan actually takes place. Very, very important. Otherwise, everybody would back out of every transaction when something bad happens. I purchase a house, and a tornado comes and destroys the house. You know what I do? I turn to the seller and say, had I known that the tornado was going to come to sell the house, I wouldn't have purchased it from you. To which the seller responds by saying, at the time that I sold it to you, it was absolutely, completely perfect. Tosus tells us that the seller wins because this was not an explicit limitation. This was not a limitation in any way, shape, or form on the sale. Now, the case that very much bothers Tosus is the case of the island, the woman who's incapable of having children. And let's understand this. This case occurs when a man marries a prepubescent girl. Now, what's the intent of the parties when a man marries a prepubescent girl? But the intent of both parties is this woman should go through puberty, develop normally such that she would be capable of having children at some point in the future. That's the overwhelming assumption of what happens to a 10-year-old girl. What's the intent of both the buyer and the seller, so to speak, that this should happen? Tosus tells us, in the top Tosus, that in those circumstances, since the intent of both the buyer and the seller is, so to speak, the man and the woman, the Mekadesh and the Mekadeshit, both of them, is that they should get married with the intent that something should happen in the future. If that does not happen, that is called Kiddushei Tov. And Meikar Adin, the woman can leave the man without a get. Can an Iolanthus who's aware of the fact that she's an Iolanthus marry a person? The answer is of course. A woman has to step forward and say, I'm incapable of having children, and I'm never going to go through puberty, and if you'd like to marry me, I'm happy to accept a marriage proposal. But when she says, I expect to go through puberty, and there's no question about any defect with me, if that turns out not to be true, that marriage is void. We derive from this a very important principle. Tov, error in marriage, is not grounded in fraud or fault. Because the one thing I can tell you for sure is this 10-year-old girl has no idea if she is or is not an Iolanthus. She doesn't know. She's not engaging in an act of deception, fraud. It's just what happens to normal people didn't happen to her. So Tosfos tells us that when there's a reasonable expectation of the parties about something that will happen in the future, and that reasonable expectation of the parties doesn't come through, that marriage is void al pidin, and no get is required. Now, we have to understand that there's a dispute about whether a get really is required midrabanan or not. A number of Rishonim aver that a get really is required midrabanan. Have to turn it on. That's the most important thing. Now it's too loud. A number of Rishonim aver that a get really is required midrabanan in that case. The reason why a get's required midrabanan is because this marriage appeared to be valid. It looked valid. If we allow women or men to end marriages without a get, there's a Marasayan problem. What's the Marasayan problem? People will think marriages can be ended without a get, and that's a bad thing. So even in those circumstances where, according to Torah law, no get is required, in some circumstances the rabbis imposed an additional requirement of a get. That additional requirement is so that people shouldn't say marriage can end without a get. That's a lesser requirement, and we will come back to that. But Tosfos's fundamental point is not to be missed. Tosfos's fundamental point is that when both parties enter into a marriage with an expectation that something will happen in the future, and that something doesn't happen, that marriage can be void, and indeed that marriage is void, is presumptively void. So far, however, we've seen absolutely no discussion about mum shebi'ish. The Rishonim only discussed the problem of the defect in a woman. The principle that they establish is well established. The principle is grounded in the Gemara here, grounded in Tosfos, grounded in the Shulchan Aruch, which quotes this routinely. When a woman hides something from the man, and this something is large enough that reasonable people will say, if I had known this piece of information, I would not have gotten married, this marriage becomes void. The Rishonim discussed it absolutely categorically in the following three cases. The case of the person who's an apostate and who hides this fact. The person's an apostate, hides this fact after they get married. They say, guess what, I'm not expected to live my life as a Jew at all. The second case is when a man gets married and he hides the fact that his brother's an apostate. And if bad things should happen to him, this woman will be stuck doing Yivam or Chalitza to the brother who's an apostate. And the third case is the mukashrin, the man who's intensely ill. Particularly in a time and a place where marriage occurs through an agent, it's possible to imagine a man appointing an agent to find a wife for him, and in the context of this agency, forgets to mention particularly important details, like, for example, the fact that this person has a loathsome disease. In all three of these cases, the Truma Sedeshin tells us that this marriage is void. And the reason why this marriage is void is because all of the parties would not have entered into this transaction voluntarily. The Shulchan Aruch, in source 3, in Kufnun Dabo, discusses the problems of, on the bottom page of the second page again, discusses the problem of defects in the man, and says that in cases of defects in the man, we can compel the man to divorce his wife. The Shulchan Aruch's position is, and the Shulchan Aruch's case is not relevant to us. However, the comments of the Beit Shmuel, the premier commentary on Ibn Ezra, certainly are. He says, in the first column of the Beit Shmuel, six lines, seven lines from the bottom, that if a man has a defect, that a coach in matter, that the case that if it develops after the marriage, we could beat him to divorce her. If he has this defect before the marriage, okay, and he hides it, that case is a case of mechatos, of a marriage that's fundamentally grounded in error at its conception, and that marriage is fundamentally void. Just like a woman can go into court and say, I want out of this marriage because my husband turned out to be a person who sees prostitutes. To use the Ramah's example, Roez Zanos, a person who hangs out with prostitutes. So too, the Beis Shmuel says, if a man suffers from this defect before the marriage, hides it, and the defect continues after the marriage, that's the case of Mechat Tos. The woman can say, I want out of the marriage. And he explicitly analogizes the rules of the man to the rules of the woman by quoting in Siman Lamed Tes. He quotes Siman Lamed Tes in Evin Ezer, which is the Siman dealing with defects in the woman. This is very important to understand. The Beis Shmuel is the earliest normal halakhic source which states what I consider to be the obvious. Just like there are defects in a woman that can lead to us declaring the marriage to be void, so too there are defects in a man that can lead to us declaring this marriage to be void. The Beis Shmuel is not telling us something novel and original. He's telling us something obvious and apparent. The obvious and apparent is that marriage is grounded on an equal relationship, just like the consent of the man is required to get married. The consent of the woman is required to get married. And Al Pi Din Torah, marriage is not at all like divorce. Divorce is unilateral. The husband has the Torah right to initiate divorce. The husband does not have the Torah right to initiate marriage. Marriage requires mutual consent. Just like there are cases where defects in the woman can cause the man to say, had I been aware of this, I wouldn't have gotten married. The Beis Shmuel says the woman can say, so too there are defects in the man that had I been aware of them, I would not have agreed to get married. And the Beis Shmuel says, in such circumstances, you can compel a get. You can force a get out of the husband so that the wife can go free. Now the question is obvious. If it's Kedusha Etos, what do we need to force any get out of? We should just let her go free without a get. So the Chazanish on the next page, source 4, picks up on this. The Chazanish says, the Mashkatu is Beis Shmuel, which studied the Bahayu below Yadav, when a man has defects and he doesn't tell her. Kofin, after Mumin, to having met up fellows, one compels, the Chazanish is in the very bottom, one can compel a divorce. Kind of the Havi Safi Kedushin. The Chazanish says, this is a perhaps marriage, a debatable marriage. The Tzarachin, Lama Yikufu Misafik. The Chazanish says, why should we compel him? Because it's a Safik marriage, it's perhaps marriage. Im Hayu Kedushin, Harenu Chayav Garshi. If it's a valid marriage, then we shouldn't beat him to require a divorce. The Im Enu Kedushin, Enu Tzarach Get. And if he's not married, you know what? What do we need to beat him for? She can go free without a get. And so, the Kevan, to who wrote the Baal, Lama Yikufu Lahosi. And since he wants to remain married to her, why should we beat him to end this marriage? The Ode Nira, and now the Chazanish tells us something very important, and it also appears to me, the woman Be'ish, Sam, when a man marries a woman and he has defects, but he doesn't talk about them, it's just a regular marriage ceremony, Havi Kedushin Vadayim, this is a definite marriage, why? Because there is no absolute presumption that she doesn't want to be married to him. The Chazanish sets for us a standard. What's the standard? The standard is that in order for a woman to get out of a marriage by saying the husband has defects, she has to present to us an umdana demucha, a categorical presumption that had she known about these defects, she wouldn't have agreed to marry him. For the purposes of this year, we'll define the categorical presumption in the following two ways. No woman would marry this man if she were aware of this defect, and this woman would not have married this man if she were aware of these defects. It comes in two different formulations, both of which are necessary. She has to show that she never would have married this person, and she has to show that most people, the vast majority of people, also would never have married this person. However, it's important to understand that we can imagine defects where we could reasonably reach this level of umdana demucha, categorical, absolute presumption. Indeed, the Oser HaKodeshim, source number 5, tells us an even more important reality. The Gemara gives us a list of defects. The question that the Oser HaKodeshim is addressing is, are these the categorical lists, or are there different lists? The first Deah quoted in the Oser HaKodeshim says that the list in the Gemara of defects is the list, and if it's not on that list, it doesn't count. The second, third Deah, which is the majority and the normative Deah, says that that's not right. What determines what a mum, a defect that either party can get out of in a marriage? It's very simple. It's something that both sides were aware of, and that society considers to be a defect. I'll give you the example that the Rishonim address that's not found in the Gemara. The problem the Rishonim address is the woman who has bladder control problems. Now, this is not found in the Gemara. One could imagine that this is a difficult mum to cope with, and the Rishonim say that in their society and in their time, a bladder control problem that was hidden at the time of the marriage is enough to cause the marriage to be called Kiddushei Tov. I'm not going to tell you whether I think that particular defect is Kiddushei Tov in our society. It might be that because these things can be medically controlled, it's not a defect. It's sufficient to note that the fact that the Rishonim are prepared to add to the list, and the fact that the Rishonim are prepared to subtract from the list found in the Gemara demonstrates to us that this list is determined not by some God-given list, not by some list found in the Chachamim, but by a simple social determination. There are lists of defects that people can't stand. Had they been aware of these defects, they would have run away from the marriage, and they would not have accepted the marriage proposal. In one society, it might be one defect. In a different society, it might be a different defect. But there is no objective list of defects. The Rishonim and the Achronim are full of discussions about what exactly are these defects. I'll give you a very modern example from the Beit Din. When I first started in the Beit Din, a woman came into the Beit Din with a letter from the Central Rabbinical Congress, the Satmar Beit Din in Brooklyn, saying that she was free to remarry even though she had been married to Tzadok Moshe of Israel. She was married for a short period of time, had a child. It turns out that neither one of her breasts lactated. Neither one of her breasts lactated, and the man walked out of the marriage because of that defect and wouldn't give her a get. And the Satmar Beit Din said that's Kiddushei Tov, because the inability of either of a woman's breasts to lactate is considered in their community to be a significant defect. She was aware of this defect and hid it. And those are the facts of that particular case. And they told her she was free to remarry without a get, because this is a mum that people are machbit on in their society, and she hid it. Thus, she's free to leave without a get. At the beginning, I was stunned. Not because I thought that this wasn't theoretically possible, but because I didn't consider this to be a defect, meaning it's less than the ideal, but in our community, given the context that we live in, I didn't think the inability to breastfeed children amounted to a mum gadol such that I would void the marriage. I picked up the phone and I called them. And they explained to me that in their community, they're very machbit on Chal Yisrael. They're more machbit on Chal Yisrael for the children than they are for the adults. The inability to breastfeed adds enormous expenses to the raising of large families. It's clear to them that this man would not have married this woman had he been aware of his defect, and that was enough for them. So I said, okay, and I put down the phone. I was a bit surprised, but I've grown to recognize that these defects are determined very contextually, more contextually than I initially thought. And that's what the Oser HaKodeshim tells us. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein, if you turn the page, has no less than 9 different tshuvot in which he discusses Kiddushei Tov as ground for ending the marriage. It all starts with his very old tshuva, the first tshuva, dealing with the man who was impotent. And the man and the woman got married. He never told her he was impotent. She soon found out about this fact. They stayed married for a little while. He eventually ran away, leaving her without a guest. Rav Moshe's analysis is very simple. Sexuality is a central component to a marriage. An inability to have a proper or even A vaguely proper sexual relationship is something that we all assume is present in a marriage. When it's not present in a marriage, that's called kiddushei tov. That's a profound error in the marriage, such that the woman can leave the marriage without a get if the husband won't give her a get, as he wouldn't in this case. This case, it happens, is easier than most, because one of the problems we'll come to later on in kiddushei tov is when the woman is aware of the defect in the marriage, and she continues to live together sexually with her husband, maybe that ratifies the defective marriage. Here, in the case of impotence, we weren't worried about that because the nature of the defect was their inability to live together. But Rav Moshe's analysis is simple. Rav Moshe's analysis is that we all know that marriage is about issues of sexuality. We all know this, he says, and the inability to have any form of a sexual relationship voids the marriage. End of discussion, Rav Moshe says, she can leave without a get. It's a long tshuva, tracing the history of this through the Beit HaLevi, through the Bar Yitzchak, but Rav Moshe's analysis is, at the end of the day, simple. It says, this man and this woman would never have gotten married had there been any sort of candid disclosure about the reality. She would not have agreed to marry him. A similar result was reached in a tshuva by Rav Yechezkel Avramsky on this same case, and a similar result was reached by Rav Avadia Yosef as well. I want to lay out for you the facts in this case. It's important to understand. She didn't leave him because he was impotent. They stayed married for 8 or 9 years in a platonic marriage. She left him because he hit her and ran away and wouldn't give her a get. Notwithstanding the fact that the toe was not what engendered the end of marriage, the presence of the toe makes the first marriage ceremony void. Since they never lived together, they never ratified the marriage that they developed for the next 8 years because they couldn't, because he was impotent. It's important to understand that. The next tshuva from Rav Moshe, tshuva 7, deals with the case of a man who's sometimes crazy and sometimes normal. He had been in and out of mental institutions. This woman, as they teach us in law school, got lucky. She met him when he was in one of his normal phases, and she fell deeply in love with him. He never told her that he had been in and out of various and sundry mental institutions, and she agreed to marry him. Soon after they got married, he flipped out again. And he'd been in a mental institution in Baltimore for many, many, many years, and he wouldn't give her a get. Rav Moshe tells us the next obvious proposition, which is no woman would marry a man who had been in and out of a mental institution and hadn't cured the problems, and had she known about the defect that he had, you know what? She wouldn't have married him. And thus, Rav Moshe says, here too, this woman doesn't need a get. This case is harder than the case of impotence, because here there was a sexual relationship. At some point, she became aware of the fact that there was something wrong with him, did not immediately leave. He eventually ran away from her. But Rav Moshe says she was never aware of the magnitude of the problem. And by the time she was aware of the magnitude of the problem, he was in the sanatorium in Baltimore. And that, too, was kiddushei tov. The analysis is simple to present in theory. The theoretical analysis is that he hid something very material from her. He hid from her the fact that he had a profoundly significant checkered history of mental illness. The third case is an even harder case. The third case involves a secular woman who gets married to a man who turns out is a closet apostate. Okay, she's not a religious Jew. She's a secular Jew. She married a person who represents himself as being a secular Jew. But you know what it turns out? Turns out he's a Christian. Was born a Jew, but had converted to Christianity. He hid this from her because he recognized that she was a secular Jew, and what did she want to marry? A secular Jew. And the fact that he was a Christian was going to prevent this marriage from happening. When she found out that he was a Christian, you know what she did? She kicked him out of the house, filed for divorce. Now, of course, this man, you know what he's not going to do? Right again. Seems to be consistent in the pattern. It's easy to imagine a man who's secretly apostatized to Christianity declining to write again. Rav Moshe advances three different svaros to explain why this woman can leave without a get, but only the one of kiddushei tov is interesting to us. Rav Moshe says, three things, and they're very important to understand. Rav Moshe says, Tav Lemetav Tandu, Mi Lemetav Armelu, applies when in fact we believe that this woman is interested in getting married for one of two reasons. Either because she needs someone to support her, or because people need a licit outlet for sexuality. Rav Moshe says that a person who's fundamentally secular, who's prepared to engage in illicit sexual relations, meaning relations outside of marriage, we generally don't apply the rule of Tav Lemetav Tandu Mi Lemetav Armelu at all, because this woman operates under little compulsion to get married, because she's self-supporting, and if she feels a need to engage in sexual relations, you know what she does? She does them. She doesn't need marriage to engage in this type of a sexual relationship. So Rav Moshe concludes that in this case, given the fact that she's demonstrated that she doesn't want him, how did she demonstrate the fact that she didn't want him? The moment she found out he was an apostate, she filed for divorce, kicked him out of the house and said, I don't want to be with you. And Rav Moshe says the normal presumption, which is even that a secular Jew doesn't want to convert out of Judaism but wants to remain a secular Jew, are strong enough to incline us to say that this is a case of Kiddushei Tov, and this woman can leave without a get and can marry another. Now, he ends by saying he has a little bit of uncertainty in this case, but he says he's inclined to be making based just on this ground alone. The fourth case involves the case of the man who's a bisexual, tshuva number 9. This man is a bisexual. He hid this fact from his wife, got married, had a perfectly fine relationship with his wife, except normally we say she found him in bed with another woman. Here, she got lucky, she found him in bed with another man. A different fact pattern, and the moment she found him in bed with another man, she left, she filed for divorce, kicked him out. He wouldn't give a get as well. The Shaila is to Rabbi Tibor Stern of Miami, who in the context of addressing the truth, a tshuva tries to argue generally that the principle of Tav Lemetav Tandu Mi Lemetav Armelu doesn't apply in our society at all, even in the religious community, and Rav Moshe rebuffs it. Rav Moshe says that we are not prepared to say that. He says, Kasha Lo Markein, it's difficult to say this because we recognize within the Orthodox community the following simple fact. Perhaps two simple facts. People do get married for some sort of an economic partnership, and people do get married because it's the only listed outlet for sex. And given those two facts, we generally say, Tav Lemetav Tandu Mi Lemetav Armelu, and we're not prepared to abandon that rule in terms of our general sociology. But let's turn to the very last paragraph of this tshuva. Avo Le'inyan Nidon Didon, tshuva number 9, the very last paragraph. Avo Le'inyan Nidon Didon, Kevin Shematinu, Shevamum Gadol, who the Etzem Echapto is Gambi Isha, Kidviarti, Vigris Moshe, Evan, Ezra, Pedagal, Simon, Ayan, Tetsim, and Pei. Since I've already established that a significant defect is a mum gadol, even for a woman, as explained in the previous tshuvas that we saw, the haval who shatus mishtav zachor, shu hato eva hayoter gedola, v'hamal biyoter, v'u davar genayu kol mishpacha, since this man is a bisexual who's involved in homosexual relationships which are particularly embarrassing even to the whole family, the culture came to you, zeginai biyoter v'ishto, in bawa bokar yoter mishtav hamal suzet, tachas mishtav ishto, who vada kedushay tov. Moshe says, here in this case, there's no doubt at all that this woman would not have agreed to marry a man who engages in homosexual relations as an alternative to marry him. Ubarulan, Shishumisha, Rohaita Mitratili, Nasel Adam, Nanuba Ubaus, Ubizoi Kazet, Bazoi Kazet. And it's clear to us that no woman would have agreed to marry a person who's suffering from this defect, Minuba Umaus, Ubizoi Kazet, this particularly repugnant difficulty. The in taken, Rosha says, if he won't give her a get, we're prepared to free her based on Kiddushei Tov. The essence of the Kiddushei Tov is the following two facts which Rosha laid out in this sentence. We are prepared to assert that almost nobody would marry a person who's a bisexual, number one. And we're prepared to assert that this woman would certainly not marry this man because he's a bisexual. We prove the first proposition from our general common sense, which is unusual to agree to marry a bisexual, and we prove the second one from the fact that the moment she discovered the defect, she got out. Those two, Rav Moshe says, are enough to allow us to say without a shadow of a doubt there is Kedushei Tov in this case, and that she can go free without a get. Rav Moshe clearly doesn't think he's arguing with the Chazon Ish we saw. What is Rav Moshe doing? He's merely proving the presence of the Ungana Demuchah that the Chazon Ish imagined. That the Chazon Ish couldn't imagine us reaching. The Chazon Ish lived in Bnei Brak, and he couldn't imagine people with a wonderful collection of defects that Rav Moshe saw all the time. And Rav Moshe says, when you reach the level of a defect, where it's obvious and apparent that nobody would marry this woman, the marriage is over. This is a very common issue, and it requires a certain amount of common sense, which is you have to recognize that there are always some hidden defects. But not all hidden defects rise to the level of saying, had we been aware of this defect, we can say our two umdanos, our two presumptions. Number one, nobody would marry this person aware of this defect. Number two, this particular person wouldn't marry this particular man in light of the defect. This turns us to the next point, which is Rav Moshe's assertion that she has to walk out immediately. And when she walks out immediately, that itself is an enormous presumption. Now I'll tell you the real world is what they did. People don't walk out immediately. You know why they don't walk out immediately? They're scared. It's difficult to walk out. Sometimes the rabbi turns to them and says, try again. Don't walk out. Maybe his homosexuality is just a one-time thing. How do you know that this is really what his life is all about? Stay in for a little while longer. The marriage therapists tell us this as well. So the problem in the real world is determining what exactly does it mean to talk about walking out the moment you immediately find the defect. The Arthur Shulchan, source number 10, addresses this question. He says, talking about a defect in a woman. And the Arthur Shulchan tells us that when a man finds a defect in a woman, he can leave. But four lines down, Amnon, in the Arthur Shulchan, the fourth word, Im Shaha Ima Akarabia, man discovers a defect in a woman while they're having a sexual relationship, Zman Harve, he stays there for a considerable amount of time, Kideras Ishvi Ishto, Harezen Mikudeshit Bivadah. The Arthur Shulchan tells us that if a man stays married to the woman, how long? He doesn't tell us. But what does he tell us is the standard? Not for a single additional sexual relationship, but Zman Harve, an ongoing relationship, we assume that he intended to marry her, and she intended to marry him, and that was their intent, and when they discovered the defect, they can live with it. How do we go about evaluating this? This is very hard to know the answer to. This is not so simple in the real world. One possibility is to say, at what point did the woman begin to think about getting divorced? I'll give you a real-world case from the basement of America. The woman found a significant defect in the man, and she immediately went to see a divorce lawyer. And you know what the divorce lawyer said? Stay in marriage for another 30 days, and spend the next 30 days collecting all the information you can about her finances. That way, when we do file for divorce, you know what? We'll get all his money. Get all his money. Not only get divorced, but you want to get a full picture of what we're getting divorced from. Okay? And in the course of these 30 days, don't let on that you want out of the marriage. But I know you want out of the marriage. Ah, your divorce attorney knows that. The man subsequently wouldn't give a gift. Now the question is the woman's return to the marriage for that 30-day period a ratification of the marriage or not? I'm inclined to think not. And the reason why I'm inclined to think not is because in order to ratify the marriage through this sexual relationship, the man and the woman have to say as follows in their own mind. I'm aware of the fact that something is wrong with the marriage. I can live with it. And I want to stay married. Now, it's clear to me that this woman said no such thing. You know what she said to herself? 30 more days of agony, and then it's going to be over. That's not at all the same as the intent a person needs to ratify their marriage through an ongoing sexual relationship. Now, how exactly do we know when this occurs? It's hard to tell. But the following observation is very important. If people go back into their marriage in anticipation of divorce, they never develop the dot necessary to remarry again through an ongoing marital relationship. I'll give you another practical example. A man and a woman are married through a civil marriage, and they're not Orthodox. They become Orthodox, as is a common phenomenon in our time. At some point, somebody turns to them and says, you know, your civil marriage isn't valid according to Jewish law. They have, if you'll excuse me, three choices. They can go to their Orthodox rabbi who will perform another marriage, a halakhically valid marriage. They can say, well, we're civilly married, and we desire to be religiously married. We'll just live together and continue to function as Mr. and Mrs. Or they can separate. In that circumstance, when they don't get married to an Orthodox rabbi, but they consciously intend to continue living together, they're ratifying their marriage at that point. Both of them know their marriage is defective. They continue to live together because they say, who cares? We love each other. We want to be married. In order to ratify a marriage that's defective, the husband and the wife both have to be aware of the fact that it's defective. They have to make the conscious decision to ratify the marriage. When that happens, there's a famous dispute between the Beit Shmuel and the Torah as to whether that marriage is ratified retroactively or whether a new marriage occurs. This is, by the way, very relevant for rabbis in the field as to whether, when you perform a second marriage of a couple that was civilly married, you make Sheva Brachos. You make Sheva Brachos. Some halakhic authorities maintain that in that circumstance, the first marriage is nothing, and the second marriage is the only one that counts. They're being married now, al pi din. You know what you're supposed to do? Make Sheva Brachos. Other halakhic authorities say that that's totally mistaken. What you're doing when you continue to live together and have a wedding ceremony is you're ratifying the first marriage, which was entered into in a technically failed way. And if you're doing that, then you don't make Sheva Brachos. You just have a party, or don't have a party, depending on whether you're really happy to be married or not. That's a different issue, as they say, appropriate for a different year. But it's important to understand that that dispute is clearly present, but in order to enter into that marriage, the parties have to know there's a defect and desire to continue this relationship. Tshuva number 11 from Rabbi Elazar Yosef addresses this exact point and addresses a man who married a woman where each of them had represented that they had had no previous sexual relations with another, and the woman did not tell the truth. The man desired to continue in the marriage anyway. Rabbi Elazar says, so they need another wedding ceremony. Now, this is Kiddushei Tov. He could leave. He doesn't want to leave. In that circumstance, should they get remarried again? And Rabbi Elazar says no remarriage is necessary. It's sufficient that they simply continue to live together. Him knowing he could leave and deciding to stay. Her knowing that he could leave. And her not wanting him to leave. So the next time they live together, Rabbi Elazar says, their intent is to ratify the marriage. He could leave and doesn't. And he's aware of that fact. And she could leave and she doesn't. So both of them are prepared to continue this relationship. The final tshuva, and then we'll stop and summarize and take some questions, is from Reb Chaim Ozer Brzezinski. Reb Chaim discussed the case from America. These things only happen in America. Reb Chaim discusses the case of a woman who's a divorcee, who's dating a man, and she asks him repeatedly, are you a Kohen? The woman says, can't marry a Kohen. He repeatedly denies that he's a Kohen. They get married. It turns out, you know what? He's a Kohen. And he always knew it. He wanted to marry her very much, knew that she wouldn't marry him if she knew he was a Kohen. So he hid it. After the marriage, it came out, and he figured she would stay with him. You know why? Because she's stuck. Because he won't give her a guess. So she's in a tough spot. She can live with nobody or live with him. So he figures she'll opt to live with him. He was mistaken. She ran away. He responded by saying, I won't give you a guess. I won't give you a guess. Now, the question is, what's the status of that marriage? This is a very difficult case. And I'll tell you why the case of Chayuvei Lavim, that you marry, is very difficult. There is no social obstacle to the marriage. The parties love each other. They very much desire to be married. However, there's a religious impediment to their getting married, which motivates one party or another to get out. Nonetheless, Reb Chaim Ozer is inclined to say that since she made it clear before the marriage that she would not marry him if he was a Kohen, the fact that she repeatedly asked many different times in many different contexts very strongly indicates that this is a case of Kiddushei Tzav. He's mistaken this with another problem in the marriage to say that this woman is free to leave without a get. But his analysis is important. To a secular person, this is not Kiddushei Tzav. A Kohen marries a divorcee, we wouldn't say all such marriages are void because we recognize in the world out there that's not a problem. Lots of secular Jews don't care at all what the rabbi says about their marriage. But what makes this Kiddushei Tzav is the fact that this woman stood on the table, proverbially, and screamed out, I don't want to marry you if you're a Kohen. And he lied to her. And he told her he wasn't a Kohen. That lahatos, he affirmatively deceived her, is enough to cause us to say that in most cases, this is a case of Kiddushei Tzav. And here we come to another principle. When a person affirmatively steps forward and says, I don't care about the social norms. This is what I'm looking for in a marriage. And the person responds by saying, okay, I fit that bill. That's an easier case of Kiddushei Tzav. Most of us don't turn to our potential spouses and say, by the way, are you a bisexual? Or, by the way, are you a lunatic? Or, by the way, are you impotent? We don't say any of those things. We operate under the umdana, the presumption that people don't step forward, that people who have these defects step forward and tell them to us. However, Chaim Moser tells us that any time one party affirmatively steps forward and says anything, if they assert it in such a way that makes it clear that this is very important to them, that's a plausible ground for saying Kiddushei Tzav. And this is the summary at some level of where we are in America. The economic truths in America and the social truths in America were astutely realized by Rav Moshe. The fact that 500 years ago, the Rishonim are not as clear that impotence is a ground for Kiddushei Tzav, or part lunacy, or bisexuality, the fact that the Rishonim, or even the Achronim in Europe, weren't prepared to label these as clearly Kiddushei Tzav, might not be dispositive to us. And the reason why it might not be dispositive to us is because in our masa, whether it be better or worse, we see a different social norm out there in marriage. Women are not set up in the sense of married off to people who they hardly know. Women pick and choose their husbands. The frequency with which we say Kiddushei Tzav increases in a society in which women have greater economic independence, and in a dating society where men pick women and women pick men, and there's an overt courtship process. On the other hand, we don't want to say this too flippantly because we recognize that everybody has defects and people come to grips with many defects. Where exactly this goes, it's hard to predict. A lot of it is grounded in social norms, and we don't have definitive answers to social norm questions. These matters are addressed in a case-by-case basis, in front of Batei Din, in front of Poskim, and of course, in all such circumstances, we try to get a get whenever we can. Thank you very much.
Before you go into the questions, let me make an announcement, if I may.
So the answer to the first question is a theoretical. It's important to answer theoretically. Moser para nimsa treifo metzo bussel. A man sells a cow, turns out to be treif, the metzah, the sale is void. Neither party is aware of the fact that this animal is treif. Intent of the party to deceive only goes to how quickly we label something Kiddushei Tavis. As a matter of halakhic theory, it makes no difference whether the intent to mislead is intentional or unintentional. Rav Chaim Ozer tells us a truth, however, which is we are more inclined to find the umdana demucha, the statistical likelihood of Kiddushei Tavis, when the woman turns to the man and says, I won't marry you if you're a Kohen. So on a real world level, the more the parties can show that this was of concern to them, and that the other side deceived them, the more likely they are. But Rav Moshe's case of impotence and his case of insanity, neither one of them dealt with lahatot, the affirmative act of fraud. It simply dealt with toh. So it doesn't, on a theoretical halakhic level, it doesn't matter.
That mean that the person marries another person and the person has a nervous breakdown?
Right.
Well,
let's take an easier case. A man has a nervous breakdown before he's married, hides that fact, okay, and then has a second nervous breakdown after he's married. I could see that being grounds for Kiddushei Tavis. The Kiddushei Tavis in your case is much harder because the man can defend himself by saying, this is not a pre-existing condition at all. This is analogous to I sell you my cow, and while you're walking out with a cow, it trips and falls. So in all cases of Kiddushei Tavis, has to have...
It has to do with chemical imbalance in the body. It could be a pre-existing condition
that
just hasn't come out yet.
Right, so this is very hard. I'll take... in the real world, the pre-existing condition that's deeply latent is one of the cases that's very bothersome. It comes out most clearly in our community in the case of latent homosexuality, where you will find people who will say this person was always a homosexual, but in truth there was not one iota's worth of homosexual activity until far into the marriage. I am inclined to say that that is not Kiddushei Tavis, because we all recognize that people have very, 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 very latent defects, and we accept the risk of those defects. That's far different from this person was a homosexual before he got married. And the comment on the basin is a...
What about the island? The case of the island's case is a latent defect.
This is a very good question. The question is, the island is a latent defect, so I'm going to answer by giving you the answer to Divrei Malkiel gives. A very latent defect that's very, very, very serious rises to Kiddushei Tavis faster than a very latent defect that's not so serious. So even if we were to show that nail biting is a latent defect, which it might be, it's not a high enough defect to rise to that level. Islandness is different because everybody recognizes the person who hasn't yet gone through puberty might never do so. But your question is a better question than I can provide a concrete answer to.
Even in the case of impotency, they were married at 20 and they had normal relations until 30, and then he became impotent at that point in time.
No, that's clearly not Kiddushei Tavis.
The rest of their life is going to be without.
They should get divorced if they want to. But that's not Kiddushei Tavis, because the time of the marriage, everything was fine. I'll tell you, they say this happens to 90-year-olds. People are happily married for 70 years, and then they stop having sexual relations. We wouldn't allow them to get out.
That's a normal time for the...
I'm sorry. Before they're married. Persons on psychiatric medication before they're married, that's Kiddushei Tavis if they don't reveal it. In my opinion, I want to answer Rabbi Billet's question, the second question, before we go on. It would be nice if this basin in Queens announced what they were doing for us to examine. My sense is that the basin in Queens is not doing Kiddushei Tavis, and that they themselves are uncertain as to whether they are doing Kiddushei Tavis or Rabbi Anslerman's Get Zikui Mehabal. Now, Rabbi Anslerman's Get Zikui Mehabal we can candidly describe as nonsensical. It's important to distinguish between things where we don't understand the sociology, like Kiddushei Tavis, and Get Zikui Mehabal, which seems to go very categorically against the breadth and depth of the Rishonim. I don't know what the future is going to bring from this basin in Queens. The basin of America sent out a letter saying that all of their activity is presumably not valid. I'll say the following, however. It would not surprise me if some of the cases are absolutely completely valid, but until there's a clear discussion about what they're doing, what is the protocol, why are they doing it, and what are they themselves doing, nothing that this basin is doing should be honored. I say this because there's a very important rule here. I'm going to give you the rule from Kashrut. Person comes to me and says, I have a way of making pig's feet kosher. You know, I learned it in open-minded yeshiva. My response always is, show me how. I'm always interested in learning and watching and being taught things I don't know. When the person turns to me and says, oh, I can't tell you. I can't show you how I make pig's feet kosher. I can only do it in the dark when nobody's watching. But trust me, I've learned not to be a trusting person. A little bit of light drives away a lot of darkness. It's vitally necessary that everybody who's in the Evan HaEzer business candidly announce what they're doing and why they are doing it. It's more important to be candid so we can each evaluate what we're doing than anything else. I think not, and I'm going to make the following social assertion. Had he revealed it, she still would have married him. Okay? I'm going to respond to you socially. People who were abused as children, they do get married. They just reveal this fact, and people who are deeply in love with them, I think continue to stay deeply in love with them and marry them. It's very important not to overplay Kedushei Tos, because lots of people who are defective find spouses. Rabbi Willig, 15 years ago when I was in Yeshir, remarked to us that one of the rules in life is every pot really does have a lid. And it's important not to let Kedushei Tos become this phenomenon, because I think the children who are abused as children subsequently turn into adults and find spouses. It's not like bisexuality. I think a person who's a bisexual really doesn't ever find a spouse. A person who howls when there's a full moon and turns into a stark raving lunatic 10 days a month never finds a spouse. Okay? So I think that it's important not to move far beyond Rav Moshe's statistical observations. You have to deal with people who had the truth come out. No normal person would have married them. I don't think children from abuse fit that model.
I think that's the Rabbi Shulman's giving the sign that that's the last question. I would just, before we conclude and make our way to the Beis Medrash, like to acknowledge the presence of Rabbi Stephen Dworkin, the Executive Vice President of the RCA, and that will conclude our first session.
Thank you.
You know what we know.